Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. From the studios of KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, this is Culture Cube, the arts show that rocks. This week on Culture Q, life integrates art.
But in my installation, Fowler becomes this transvestite figure, sort of like androgynous.
One time my roommate tried to make lasagna, and she like didn't cook the noodles and just put them in the oven. It was weird.
Tiny back room with its own bathroom and a friendly staff, and I'm solid gold. You got whiskey? Great.
By the way, if we love this so much, we ought to put our money where our mouth is to support it.
Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Noel Clark. Art is all around us. It's in museums, in the creativity we employ when our choices are limited. It's in the way we keep music in our lives and let it direct us. In 1889, Oscar Wilde said, "Life imitates art far more than art imitates life." So in that spirit, we bring you stories of Russian spiritual art, creative culinary choices, extracurricular orchestras, and a Chicago musician transplanted to the Twin Cities. All this and more tonight on Culture Q, and it starts right now. All art wants to be seen, whether it be a child's proud scribbles stuck to the fridge, or a musician performing for thousands of people. Producer Amy Friedman finds Russian artists willing to stare down bulldozers for this very right. Luckily, art proves more weighty than boulders, and these artists more stubborn than any bulldozer.
With ethereal music floating through high, gaping arches, it would be easy to believe that you were in a church. There even seemed to be church bells. But this building hasn't been a church for 53 years. Now, it is the Russian Museum of Art. Its arches and Romanesque windows perfectly frame their newest exhibit, Concerning the Spiritual in Russian Art.
Okay, so let me tell you about this, and it's going to be interesting for some.
And those were not church bells.
So basically, I'm using Maximus P to generate sound. I'm analyzing data coming from this controller, and based on the rotation speeds, I create different notes.
This is all part of an interactive installation by Igor Malachevsky. It's called The Return.
It deals with the state of religion in Russia and the patriarchal society. And traditionally, when you see Return of the Prodigal Son, it shows an image of the son and the father. But in my installation, father becomes this transvestite figure, sort of like androgynous. I'm trying to reference the impossibility of the return.
This installation is one of the edgiest pieces the museum has ever shown. It deals with spirituality, but in a very unconventional way. However, the more works I saw, the more the question arose, is there really any right, wrong, or conventional way to express spirituality?
I think in today's world, with all the difference in religion, it's very important to find the tolerance for all of us in contemporary art society. That's why we decided to address the subject matter, and each artist individually addresses it differently.
That was Natalia Kledzi. Most of the artwork for this show came from her and her mother's art collection. Tolerance is important to them because they remember a time defined by intolerance.
I mean, people, the works who created in the 70s, when religion was banned, and it was kind of like search for spirituality and against the government, saying, please, look, the religion exists.
This exhibit honors the artists who have fought their whole lives for free expression.
It's a bulldozer exhibition when the government, in September of 1974, the government sent fire trucks against the art, and a lot of artworks were destroyed, and we have several pieces in our collection from that show. A few artists who presented in our exhibition were participants in the bulldozer exhibition, Askar Rabin, and also Tatiana Levitskaya.
Things have gotten a lot better in Russia, but there are still problems.
And nowadays, with Russia and the new censorship with the Pussy Riot and some other stories which are in the news.
Remember Pussy Riot? They were imprisoned just last year for inciting religious hatred. While the reasons for censoring these Russian artists have flipped, for the Kledzis, the problem remains the same.
Myself, I do not agree with the Pussy Riot action, but I will support them endlessly, and I don't think they should be in prison. Not because they women and mothers, but also, people have a right for self-expression.
And sometimes, breaking down censors can lead to some small discoveries in a very big way. Here's Steve Alderson, not Russian, not an art expert, but an art lover.
I have lived in this neighborhood for 40 years, and the museum has come to be my part of town. The presence of this museum at this location and the quality that they have brought to it has given me an education in it that I didn't otherwise have.
For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
Most college students can relate to a time when they've opened the kitchen cupboards in search of sustenance and found their options few and far between. So this week, new reporter Megan Noyce asks, what's the weirdest food you've eaten out of desperation?
I ate a whole bag of Kit Kats once. It was worth it.
One time my roommate tried to make lasagna, and she didn't cook the noodles and just put them in the oven. It was weird.
We're still freshmen. We don't make our own food very much, so I don't know.
I would have to say, oatmeal. I don't like oatmeal, and it's just disgusting. So, but I was last minute ditch effort, and I was I'm hungry. It was finals week, too, so I didn't have time to go out.
One time I blended Oreos and a little bit of milk because I thought since they're so good separately, together they might be. It was terrible. It was a terrible experience. It was a terrible meal.
I don't know. Ramen.
Ooh, the most desperate meal? I probably just eating turkey. Lunch meat, just straight from the pack.
I frequently eat canned chili mixed with bags of rice that you get at the grocery store, but
I don't think that's that bad. Come on.
Usually I don't eat less than the entire bag of anything, so.
Yep.
Couple sausage sticks and some Pop-Tarts.
Rice, Spam, and eggs.
Rice, Spam, and eggs with sriracha.
With sriracha sauce.
There we go. Have you had cereal with water? Cereal with water, absolutely. Cap'n Crunch. Well, generic Cap'n Crunch with water, absolutely.
My name's Markita, and I'm a producer here at Culture Q. On this week's Soundscope, I'll be playing some sick songs for you to listen to when you're ill. The first time you're sick in college, it's a huge milestone. When you're ill, you just want to be at home. But since you don't have your mom or dad or cat nearby to help nurse you back to health, music is where you go to seek comfort. Dreams by Fleetwood Mac helps remind me of my own ma and pa and always makes me feel just a little bit better.
Oh,
Sufjan Stevens' I Want to Be Well is as much about mental health as physical, but it's still a good listen nonetheless. If there were a way to sort of musically mirror the downward spiral you fall through when you're sick, Young Bride by Midlake would be just that, but in the most beautiful and best way possible. When you reach the bottom of that hole, or the height of your sickness, things can get pretty gloomy and you start preparing for the worst, even if it's a little bit overdramatic, which is why last time I was sick, I decided if I died, I wanted When You Come Back Down by Nickel Creek to be played at my funeral. I'll still be there when you come back down. But when I was feeling down, Wayne Coyne and the other fellows from The Flaming Lips were there to help pick me up with the song, Do You Realize? That's it. Those are my chicken noodle and soup songs for your sick musical soul. Do you realize?
Since October, the Minnesota and St. Paul Chamber Orchestras have been locked out of their workplaces by management, outraging the community. Negotiations have shown little promise, discouraging all who are affected. Some prominent members have taken the matter into their own hands. Reporter David DeMarc has more.
Could you tell me where we are right now?
Right now, we are in the Bryn Mawr neighborhood of Minneapolis, outside of a local coffee shop called Cup of Java.
The voice you just heard belongs to Minnesota Orchestra principal trombonist Douglas Wright. That we had to meet at such an odd location is an unfortunate side effect of the lockout that has kept Minnesota Orchestra musicians, along with director Osmo Vanska, out of their usual habitat starting October 1st. Since then, orchestra members have kept busy in all the ways they can. Wright, in particular, has been performing with other orchestras around the nation.
It's been interesting. It's been great on one hand because I've gotten to meet some wonderful people and learn some different styles. In fact, a few weeks ago, we played Sibelius' Second Symphony with New York Philharmonic, with Lauren Mizell conducting, and it's very, very different.
However, not every aspect of his experience has been positive.
So it's been great to meet some new friends, learn, you know, hear some different styles, learn some new things. But I always sorely miss my own orchestra and always love coming home.
The rest of the community is missing his orchestra almost as much as he is. Nobody knows that better than three-term mayor R.T. Rybak, who told me over the phone about some of the consequences his city has faced.
We've already had huge repercussions in this community from the lockout, ranging from obviously the lost revenue at the orchestra itself, but from the bars and restaurants nearby, out in the community, from the dollars that the artists put into the community, to just the idea that we have one of our great institutions that is idle. how do you put a dollar or even a value on what's lost when one of the great arts institutions in one of the great art cities is not performing? It's huge.
On Friday, at the request of Mayor Ryback and wealthy benefactor Judy Dayton, the orchestra played their first concert with locked-out director Osmo Vanska in several months to celebrate a recent Grammy nomination. Here's Ryback again.
The Minnesota Orchestra is an incredible institution in this town, and we recognize there's a complicated labor issue there, but we can't possibly allow a great moment like a Grammy nomination to go uncelebrated.
Ryback also stressed the need for members of the community to voice their positions.
We love this institution. We back this institution. And by the way, if we love this so much, we ought to put our money where our mouth is and support it.
The mayor's actions haven't gone unnoticed by those that they affect.
I think the mayor has been watching the situation very closely, but this is sort of the most public stance he's taken. And not that it's necessarily a stance, but, you know, a move that he's made.
I don't think my job is to dictate how this labor issue gets resolved, but it is my job and the job of every single person in this community to just insist that the sides keep talking and try to bring this to a resolution as soon as possible.
Ryback may not be taking sides in the issue, but he has made it quite clear that his top priority is getting the orchestra back to business.
We need the orchestra performing. We need this for some real bottom line reasons. We need it for our cultural psyche and future. And we simply need people to do what is I'm sure, clear to them. They've got to keep talking. They've got to settle this thing because it matters an enormous amount to our city.
At some point, somewhere down the road, we're going to come to some sort of agreeable terms. It's just a matter of when and what those terms are going to be. So it's going to happen. I just don't want to win.
That said, Wright does still insist that there are grave consequences for the quality of the orchestra if a resolution is not reached quickly.
We lost a number of players with the lead up to this thing. We've lost at least one or two permanently since this lockout started. A lot of the other great orchestras are hiring again. And if this lockout continues, you know, they're going to start filling their vacancies with our people.
However, despite the bleak circumstances, Wright is still excited for Friday.
Mostly, I'm looking forward to playing with my colleagues on stage once again. It's been, we played a concert back in December, so it's been about 6 weeks since we've played together, and it's going to be a tremendously powerful experience for us to come together with our music director. I haven't seen Osmo since July sometime, so this is going to be quite an experience for us.
For Culture Q, this has been David DeMarc.
Happy Groundhog Day, Culture Q listeners. My name is Zach. I'm joined in studio right now with Tess.
Thanks for having me.
And we figured it might be a good idea to count down some top seven alternatives to Mr. Punxsutawney Phil, the famous groundhog from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Excuse me. That's really hard to say.
It's a
Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. And we thought, you know, what if it didn't have to be a groundhog? What if we had some sort of other animals that could represent 6 weeks or not more of winter? So, without further ado, let's start our list. Number seven on this week's top seven, you know, we figured we'd start off with something that really represents America, a national symbol, you know, like apple pie or baseball, the bald eagle.
Exactly. We think it'd be cool if the bald eagle could be the new groundhog for Groundhog's Day, because how cool would it be instead of, you know, an animal seeing its shadow if we decided if there's going to be more winter, if like the bald eagle caught some kind of rodent and like that was how we were going to tell if there was more winter.
Swoop down. You can imagine like the scream of the eagle. It'd make really great TV.
Yeah, it's a bit more entertaining than, you know, boring shadow.
All right. Well, Moving right along, number six was a special request of Tess.
I wanted number six to be a bunny because I love bunnies. And, you know, it's around groundhog size, so it wouldn't be too much of an adjustment for America. You know, change is sometimes hard for people to deal with.
It is scary.
Yeah, so I thought that that would be a good one. And there's bunnies everywhere, so people could maybe relate to the bunny.
Bunnies are also supposed to be very intelligent, too, for their rodent size. So, I mean, maybe that would be better at determining whether or not it saw its shadow.
Exactly.
Take that, groundhog.
Right.
Number five. Oh, yeah, go for it.
Number five, Zach.
Yes. I've always felt a special kinship with the grizzly bear. So maybe we should talk about a really big, intimidating animal that would, like, scare away America's enemies.
Right. Or scare away, like, winter.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what if we could pick an animal that was so badass that we could scare winter into submission?
I think a grizzly bear would be a good choice.
So, you know, then Grizzly Bear Day every year wouldn't be like, oh, is there going to be more winter? It would be like, there's not going to be more winter because the grizzly bear came out.
Right.
I would love that.
I think that'd be good.
Again, good TV, too. You know, bear hibernating, kind of lumbering out of the looking.
Right. We're all about mass media here at Radio K. So
I'm kind of running out of stuff, though. I mean, we went through all the rodents. What about, like, small mammals? We got, like, now gopher. I don't know. That's a little too easy.
It's too easy.
What about the badger?
No, we can't do badgers.
Yeah, no, definitely not the badger.
We don't like badgers.
Okay, here. Number four is definitely not badger. moving along to number three, a personal selection of mine. If we got to have bunnies because they're cute, then what we really ought to have is sloths, because sloths are so cute.
They're cute, but why would they be good for, you know, replacing the groundhog?
Well, here's the thing, though. Like, sloths take a really long time to do stuff, and I know that a lot of people complain that they didn't get to catch the groundhog come out of the hole on Groundhog Day, and they really wanted to watch it live. It's, like, important to them. And the sloth would take probably a couple of hours to make the trip down from the tree and kind of lumber over to see if maybe it had a shadow. And so you could make sure to catch at least, like, a little bit of it live.
I think that's a good point. That's a good contender.
All right. Well, number two is not actually an animal. It's a fictional character.
Yes, we decided on Peter Pan for number two because if you remember at the beginning of the movie, his shadow is unattached to him. It has a life of its own.
This is kind of part of the Peter Pan folklore. He's forever young, but also his shadow and him are divorced. It's got its own mind, its own being. And, you know, maybe if Peter Pan came out to check on his shadow on Peter Pan Day and his shadow was just off at the club somewhere or something, we wouldn't even have to deal with winter.
Right. We wouldn't have to deal with that, you know, deciding if the shadow's going to come out. He's off doing his own thing.
Yeah, great. And number one, this is probably my favorite selection because, you know, winter's great. But really what we want to hear on Groundhog Day isn't that we're going to have six more weeks of winter. I mean, no one really wants to hear that.
No one wants to hear that.
Even if you're the most hardcore winter person on the planet, you're kind of looking forward to that groundhog not seeing their shadow. So on National Mole Day, we'd never have to worry about the mole seeing a shadow because the mole would not be able to see once it came out from underground.
Exactly.
And
so,
they're kind of cute. They have those, well, actually, they're not all that cute. They got the kind of the weird little noses.
Yeah, they're a little weird, but on the bright side, it wouldn't be able to see its shadow, so we chose mole for number one.
All right, well, that's this week's top seven replacements for Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. My baby, I struggle just to believe it. You were
saying, I could release it. Feed into my heart, feed into my brain. Astronautilus is not a local musician, but for all intents and purposes, he's been adopted into the Minneapolis hip-hop scene by fans and his peers. At a special event at the Hole and Kaufman Union on the university campus, producer Matt Curtis spoke with Astronautilus, known to his parents as Andy Bothwell, about his connection to the Twin Cities, how he got his start in hip-hop, and his plans for the future.
I taught myself how to rap while I walk my dog. I recorded the
Whole Music Club has a different vibe tonight. The lights are dim and stagnant. The chairs are arranged like a school assembly. The instruments on stage have been replaced with comfortable-looking chairs. And the usual turbulent crowd is sober and alert, hanging on the words of this well-spoken man, with or without the addition of his backing track.
Sort of do an interview / performance / Q&A, and we're going to learn all about me, as opposed to a crowd of people getting drunk and, like, you know, spilling beers on each other and all of us yelling and cheersing whiskey glasses.
I saw the door and I looked through the entrance, stared out night sky, the pattern seeming endless.
Broken friendship, dandy dog unleash. Door latch caught spot, shoot a stop on street.
This man is Andy Bothwell, or Astronautless as he is known on stage, visiting the University of Minnesota as part of the Making Music series. He's here to share his experiences, his past, and his influences.
That's my dad, Charles Wilson Bothwell. He was born in San Antonio, Texas, and he was sort of very much like me. Like, he hated his job, and he was, for the first time, making a bunch of money, and he hated his bosses, and they wanted him to move to Chicago, and he told them to f*** off. Really proud of my dad for doing that. And, like, I have kind of held on to that f*** off attitude ever since, so as much as my dad wishes I had health insurance.
And perhaps most importantly, what brought him here to Minneapolis in the first place, and how he came to call the Twin Cities his home.
I've been living in Seattle for about 3 years, and I liked Seattle, but had sort of become clear that it wasn't the city for me. I'll take the brutal cold of Minneapolis with sun over the relentless gray and misting of Seattle any day of the week.
He didn't make the decision to come to the Twin Cities all by himself. He had a lot of persuasion from fellow rapper POS, co-founder of the hip-hop group Doomtree. They met at Warped Tour in 2004 and have been friends ever since.
I started to just look around for places to live, and I had been coming to Minneapolis working on music with POS for projects with him. And every time I would come here, I'd be like, man, this city's the best. And Steph would just say things like, in his like Steph way, like, we should just live here. We should just live here. And I was like, maybe I'll live here. And he's like, just do it. Do it. You should do it. You're going to do it. And like, I'd be like, all right, yeah. And then eventually I was like, I think I want to move here. And he's like, well, duh. Like, and so, yeah, that was it. Yeah.
Andy has made his way around the block a few times and has certainly made this place a home, playing almost every venue in Minneapolis, and finds pleasure in the quaintest place.
Without a doubt, the Triple Rock. The Triple Rock is still my favorite. I love the Triple Rock, and I think I'm kind of getting to a point where I might have to move to a bigger venue than the Triple Rock, which is one of those great problems to have. The Triple Rock is the Triple Rock. Yeah, no, a good sound system, a tiny back room with its own bathroom, and a friendly staff, and I'm solid gold. You got whiskey? Great.
The Minneapolis hip-hop community has proudly adopted Astronautless as one of their own. It's not hard to see why.
Him and, you know, Doomtree and that circle of people, you know, from meeting Steph to meeting Doomtree, from meeting those people to meeting gangs to meeting all this kind of like giant little wonderful little creative, you know, nebula that is Minneapolis. Like, that was the thing that sold me. Like, once I sort of meet all these people, it was just like, these people think like I think, they create like I create. This is where I need to be. And it just became clear that this was the city that I felt at home in. This is the first time that I'd ever been in a place in a long time where I felt like this is my place. And I fell in love, and it became abundantly clear that of all the places in the world, this is where I needed to be. And I regret nothing about it. It was a great choice.
Andy trusts and respects this tight-knit community, so much so he's collaborating with POS himself on his next album. But due to both artists producing their own albums last year, as well as Steph's health problems, progress has been slow recently.
If everything goes according to plans with, you know, health, well-being, and business, we'll probably start hearing music from it this year. But, you know, I said that last year too. So it's just one of those things that when we have time, we work on it. We don't rush it. We're not going to put it out unless it's done. And I'm pretty pleased with the way it's going so far.
The future is bright for Andy. His decision to get out of battling and into music production was not a waste by any stretch of the imagination. He will be returning home again on the 23rd of February at the Fine Line Cafe, supporting Y with plenty of Minneapolis concerts to come in the future. He is a much experienced adopted local talent with more than enough support to make for a pretty decent homecoming for whenever he decides to come back to the Twin Cities. And it's great to have him here whenever he does. This is Matt Curtis with Culture Q.
This is just like a regular show. Sweat and taking off clothes.
That's our show. This week you heard from Amy Friedman, Megan Noyce, Marquita Fornoff, David DeMarc, Tess Weinberg, Zach McCormick, and Matt Curtis. Producers for Culture Q are Mitch Skinner, Marquita Fornoff, Amy Friedman, and Matt Curtis. Our culture coach is Sarah Lemanchek, and your host and managing editor is Noel Clark. You can find archives of our show on RadioK.org and follow us on Facebook. We'll see you next week. Working secret under cover of darkness, hand steadied by the weight of a lie. support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.